This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Well, we have a novelist with us today, Barbara Quick. And when I read her first novel, well, it was her second, an early novel, Vivaldi's Virgins, I said, I have got to meet this author. I will do anything to meet this author. And I did make it happen. And today I'm bringing her to you. Barbara Quick, hello.
Oh, Grace, so good to see you. Thank you for having me on the show.
How's California?
Beautiful? Well, it's beautiful there. I've got all these beautiful spring flowers blooming in my garden now.
So besides being a novelist and a poet, she is a rabid vegetarian gardener and florist and has a little farm and a vineyard. But Barbara Quick, there's a new novel just premiering this month. Please tell us the title and just what it's about.
Well, the novel is called What Disappears. And even though it's my fourth novel, I actually started this novel when I was still just a poet, when I was 21 years old and living in a stone cottage in West County, Cork, Ireland, writing with blue fingers. I started writing my first extended piece of prose fiction. I called it The Russian Winter. And it was based on stories my maternal grandmother told me about her life growing up as the daughter of a family of tailors in Kishinev, which is actually in the news a lot now. And I was so moved by her stories and so intrigued by them, I started writing, recreating this story about how she was, her first kiss was from the pharmacist's son, Yasha. My family's Jewish, and Kishinev was in the Pale of Settlement, where Jewish people were allowed to live and where my grandparents thrived as tailors. And so I started writing this story, but I got to about 100 pages and I didn't know where to go with it. It didn't go any further, but it stayed with me. And after that, I wrote my first novel after I came back to California. The first novel takes place in Arctic Alaska, a completely different kind of novel. And then I wrote my second novel, which you referenced, Vivaldi's Virgins, and a third YA novel called A Golden Web. But then the story called to me again. And I think the reason it called to me was because one of the stories Nana told me was that her mother would twice a year take the train to Paris to see the fashions, which made absolutely no sense to me because my great-grandmother was a humble woman. I'm sure she didn't speak French. She was making the hats and coats for the local parochial school, which caused the priest to offer shelter to her and her family whenever there was a pogrom, which was an amazing thing for them, a moment of kind of guilty safety, I think. But why would she have to go to Paris twice a year? I mean, that expense, she was not a rich woman, and also the danger to go alone.
Well, when I read this book, I could not believe that someone could put together such an ambitious account of a family saga, which starts in the end of the 1800s into the early 1900s, follows all the characters in this family to another continent, to another time, actually shows us the history of ballet at that time, factually accurate, and the fashion industry. It was so much to do. So I want to put that aside and talk about process in a minute. But I'm very interested in your telling us about what triggered this. So it was like on ice in the back of your mind as you produced other works of art.
For 40 years it was on ice.
Oh, that's why I tell people never throw away what you're writing. It will work for you later. So what was the moment, the urgency that knew that story had to be told and it had to be told now?
Well, what made it happen for me, it's a very personal thing. I only have one sister and she made the decision that she didn't want to be in my life anymore. And that was about a decade ago. And it was devastating for me. It's still devastating for me, but it suddenly gave me the idea of what could be a strong enough motivation for somebody, this humble Russian seamstress, to leave her home, to leave her country and travel to Paris to see the fashions. She was looking for something else. And in my mind and imagination, that's where the idea grew of a twin looking for her long-lost sister.
Well, we're going to hear more about that. How do you do it? I mean, so you get this idea, you start writing 100 pages, and then do you make a list of characters? Do you have a template or a blueprint, like an outline? Do you just go organically with it? How do you actually begin to write a novel?
Well, I'm going to answer that question with a poem, Grace, because I think
a true poet.
This is a poem that I wrote around that time, or actually just before the time that I was in Ireland writing the Russian winter. And I think it explains a lot about how haunted I was and have been by my Russian Jewish ancestors. This is called Crow's Feet. Great grandmother came to me in a dream, fluttered at my windowsill, in her hands a needle and thread. "Don't believe what they tell you about angels, my child," she whispered in Russian. Only then I noticed her wings, glossy black against the lace curtains. Her feet were tiny and pale, cloud-like. She said, "I am the weight of your mother and your mother's mother. I am the tongue grown heavy with silence." She planted one foot each upon my eyes. I slept, the smell of feathers in my nostrils. And today, I see crow's feet at the corners of my eyes, a breath of the shtetl over the bed, and black feathers everywhere.
That is chillingly beautiful. So we're hearing that this story is in your DNA.
Yes, it really is. I was quite close to that grandmother, Nana, and I've written a lot of poems in her persona. And I'm also, I've been a very avid tailor myself. I learned to sew when I was 12 years old. I took a tailoring course. I made fully lined suits. I was kind of very zealous with that. I loved beautiful clothing and I couldn't afford it. And so I decided to make my own beautiful clothing.
And thus the passion of the fashion industry, which you explore in the novel. It shows a passion that couldn't have come from just a disassociated writer. There is also your love of ballet and the accuracy of the performers and the times and the music. You must know music.
Well, music is a very big force in my writing. I wrote this novel often. I worked on it while I was listening to Brahms' Second Symphony. It just particularly speaks to me. And I've come to associate different instruments with different characters in my novel. So now when I hear the symphony performed, I mean, as you know, Grace, my husband's in the San Francisco Symphony. And so I go to the symphony quite often. And when I hear this performance, I feel my characters' hearts when I'm hearing the music. And that's been my ambition, is to write a novel that would touch people's emotions in the same direct way that a beautiful piece of music does.
And you are a dancer, which has to do also with the imprint of music. Well, we're going to hear a little bit of the novel. But first, I'm just going to read this, because I can't memorize it. Barbara Quick, novelist and poet, is known as the author of the 2007 novel, Vivaldi's Virgins. It's still in print, translated into 13 languages, made into an audiobook, and currently in development as a miniseries. Not too bad. Winner of the Discovery Great New Writers Prize for her first novel, Northern Edge, and was awarded at 2020 an award for her poetry, the Blue Light Press Poetry Prize for her debut book of poetry. So this is just a tip of the iceberg for Barbara Quick, who is a woman of all seasons. And the new book is called What? What's the title of your book?
The title is What Disappears.
And we're going to hear just a bit of it now, read by the author, Barbara Quick.
Thank you. Thank you, Grace. Just to set this up a little, the scene is the Jewish orphanage for girls in Kishinev in Tsarist Russia. And there is a French couple who has come to the orphanage, a childless couple, in which the mother, the woman, not a mother, very much wants to be a mother. She had a Jewish grandmother way back when, and her idea is that this is where her baby is, because she's tried and failed to have a child of her own. So they've come to the orphanage, this French couple. A cascade of silvery, distinctly babyish laughter reached their ears from the floor above them. Madame Dupré reacted to the sound like a hunting dog that scents its prey. Following her gaze, Golda said, "Oh, that is just Sonia and Zanetta, always making jokes together. Special case. I can show you youngest orphans in day room now. Very nice girls. I cannot authorize, but you can look. This way, please." But before she could stop them, Madame Dupré, surprisingly fleet in her high heels, had launched herself upstairs. Her husband had to take the stairs two at a time to keep up with her. Golda scurried after them, calling out, "Madame, Monsieur, not that way, please." Passing two empty dormitories on the hallway, they entered a third, smaller room where all the bassinets were empty save one. Madame took her husband's hand, leading him straight to the bassinet that held Sonia and Zanetta. Entranced, Madame looked down at the babies, perfect baby girls, perhaps 9 months old. One slept or pretended to sleep, while the other looked up with large blue eyes at the two strange faces hovering above her. Her delicate brows knitted, and her tiny chin began to quiver. But then her gaze lit on the brooch Madame Dupré wore on her lapel. It shimmered with a setting of dark pink rubies and very small diamonds, very small, very shiny in the slanting light that came in through the window. The baby's face broke into a smile as she reached out with one dimpled hand toward the magenta-tinged sparkles of color and light. Madame Dupré's eyes filled with tears. She reached down and gathered the baby into her arms, embracing her with all the unused genius of her frustrated maternity. "Oh, my sweet little darling, I knew I'd find you here." Neither Madame nor Monsieur Dupré paid any attention to Golda's objections, which segued from French to Russian as her voice became more and more agitated. "I will lose my position, you ridiculous people," she shouted at them in Russian. "Do you have a heart in your body? Have I not used the correct word for twins? Jumelles," she shouted in French. "Les jumelles. Zanetta is one of two. They must not be separated."
Oh, and then the story begins of how these two found each other and the traumas and the joys. Barbara, detail, smelling, tasting, hearing. Is the poet a novelist or is the novelist a poet? Are you so involved with the world that nothing passes by you? Every minute you're noticing, tasting, and seeing?
That's a hard question to answer. I think that I think my heart is very open to the world, and my senses are very open to the world. And as a child, I often felt quite overwhelmed by the most ridiculous things. The color red, for instance, you know, a tulip. It would just be this overwhelming thing. I think maybe a little bit hallucinogenic, you know. And it's continued to be that way for me.
Well, your pages are on fire. Your pages are on fire. So I'm going to just tell you a little bit more about her now that you have heard her writing. This book is premiering this month worldwide, and it has been a decade in the making?
Or the actual writing of this version of the novel, the expanded version, What Disappears, is about a decade in the making. But really, I started writing the story 40 years ago.
Well, also, your poems have been recorded by Garrison Keillor and featured on the Writer's Almanac. And you've been on The Poet and the Poem as one of our favorites before. So now you have a full page spread in the Scientific American. And is this a centerfold?
It's a lovely spread that they made, a full page with an illustration. And it's a poem of mine that was inspired by my son, Julian. It was curated by Davis Sobel for her poetry column in Scientific American.
We're sagging right away to your poetry then. So let us hear, we know a little bit about the novelist. Let us have a bit of the poet. Tell us what you're going to read to us.
Well, I chose this poem. It's a relatively new poem, but the reason I chose it is that it really connects with the longing in the novel. And do you know that Brazilian word saudade, Grace?
I think you've told me once, but I know you're a Brazilian dancer, so I might have heard it.
I love Brazilian Portuguese. I love that language. And this is a word that I haven't found translated well into any other language in the world. Saudade refers to longing, yearning, a missing. It can be longing for a person who's gone, who's died, or you've just been separated from. It can be longing for a feeling that you once had. It can be longing for a certain scene or a certain aspect of nature that you'll never see again. And I think that saudade is something that a lot of people are feeling in the world right now, especially in places like Ukraine. So this novel is really all about saudade. It's longing, yearning for something that you feel has been ripped out of your heart. And I'd like to read this poem called Sisters, Love, Longing, which is very much connected to the feeling in this novel, but in a very personal way. I don't usually connect the dots between my poetry and my fiction, but I'm going to in this case, just because it's you, Grace. Sisters, love, longing. I can still see your smile as I saw it 30 years ago, as you lifted your laughing infant daughter in the air. I look with envy now at pairs of sisters from families happier than ours, the tender bond between them. As they look into the camera, the younger one leaning her head on the other's shoulder. I wanted to be that for you as we grew older. Instead, you decided for your own private reasons to cut me out of your life. I'm haunted by the memory of your pretty face, the little hand I held in the gap between your crib and my bed in the room we shared. I still remember the words to those long Irish ballads I used to sing you to sleep, and my cluelessness, as you hinted when we were grown, that antipathy, resentment, or both had replaced the trust and affection you'd always shown. My love for you awakened my capacity to love selflessly, paved the way to someday love a child of my own. And at 17, when you were only 8 years old, I left home. If I had known the dangers lurking there, I swear I would have found a way to rescue you, but I was busy rescuing myself. I strive to change our story in my novels and my poems, to find a way for both of us to face our separate tribulations side by side, as other pairs of sisters so often do, growing up and growing older, staying close even if the other lives far away, continuing to care, being there.
Barbara Quick, author of a new novel, What Disappears, and an award-winning poet. And that union is certainly reflected in the novel. And the one sister loving the other more, maybe, even shows up. So I see how the yearning and the longing is present and informed the novel. That is, I have an insight now I did not have before. Barbara, thank you for that. You know, Rumi says that the wound is where the light comes in.
Yes.
So when you think of that wound and then the light that came from it, the novel, is that a fair bargain?
Yes.
I think so.
I think it is. Even though, yes, there's been a tremendous amount of pain. I really didn't know if I was going to survive my childhood.
Well, you know, the definition of an artist is a child who has survived. So let us take another moment for another poem so that we get more of you. And this is Barbara Quick, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress on Remote. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
Well, this is a sonnet. I don't usually write metered poems, but it's about a little bit about my life as a dancer. I have a lot of dance training. I was never a ballerina. I just didn't have the body or the talent for it, or the turnout really was what I didn't have. So, but I took up every other kind of dance. And in my adult life, I joined a troupe of Brazilian dancers. I started studying with them, and I've danced in 6 carnival parades. And I still, even at my advanced age, I still do Brazilian dancing. And it's one of the most joyful things I know about in the whole world. During lockdown, you know, there were no classes. And it was awful. I felt like part of me was dying. And I wrote this poem about that. It's called In the Before Times. In the before times, we took dance classes, not online, but body to body, in a room with a sprung wooden floor. Unmasked, barefoot, and scantily clad in lycra, we greeted each other with hugs, big hugs. We embraced the drummers, too, if we knew them, and flashed our unprotected smiles when the choreography sent us flying past them. I know it's hard to understand now, but we didn't worry about rogue droplets of sweat or aerosolized breath that might worm their way in and consign us to horrible illness or death. We thought only of the wild joy of dancing.
Let's have another poem. Barbara,
oh, gosh. Okay. Let's see. I'm going to read a poem from my collection.
And the title of the book is what?
The book is The Light on Sifnos. And it's about, poems I wrote on an absolutely haunted Greek island. I don't know, should I read Skinny Dipping in Vathi?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Skinny Dipping in Vathi. And actually, it was so wonderful hearing Garrison Keillor read this one. I loved it. Above the azure inlet of the sea, the path was steep, carved out between the thistles, thorns, and wind-blown rock. He left her at the top to find a sheltered place they wouldn't be seen descending to the shore. She waited, fully clothed there, till looking down she saw his gleaming skin and upturned face above the churning deep, as if he'd changed from man to seal and loved this transformation. She shed her clothes and picked her way as far down as she could on tender feet. and took a leap of faith, exchanging rock for empty air, a rush of cold and bubbles in her hair. Her toes touched seaweed as she swam toward her selkie mate. Two naked, slippery people, 70 and 65, feeling so alive and filled with joy, treading water side by side in the extra salty turquoise blue Aegean Sea, rich in iodine with the power to heal all kinds of wounds. They tasted salt and kissed, two shipwrecked sailors who'd managed to survive.
Yes, that book is not only about place, but relationship. And I do recommend that, too. It's on sale. You can get it through Amazon?
Yeah, you can get it anywhere. You can order it at your local independent bookstore or Amazon.
I think it's a story of two people, and the place is captured indelibly. But let's go back to the big story of the month, and that is the premiere globally of the novel What Disappears. And this, it's Sleepless Author, who has too many events this month, but who's soldiering on. Let us have another part of your novel.
Absolutely. So one of the twins who, I don't want to give away too much of the story, but one of the twins has become a ballet dancer, and she's gotten a part as a sort of pickup dancer for Sergei Diaghilev's Ballet Russe, which was the most amazing cultural phenomenon in Belle Époque Paris, and perhaps the biggest cultural phenomenon of the Western 20th century. All the great artists, designers, writers, composers, dancers, fashion designers were involved and brought together by Diaghilev. And so it's wonderful to be able to show these people and let them live again with their stories threaded, with my fictional character stories threaded into their stories. I did a huge amount of research, and I feel pretty confident that when the historical characters are speaking, I think their voices are true, because I read their memoirs and recordings of the conversations and so forth. But Jeannette, as she's been named in France, has just had some shocking news. And yet she has to go on stage for the debut of Les Sylphides. It's terrifying. So much that Jeannette could do with ease before is hard now. At 29, she already feels old. She knows that her jumps aren't as high. Her heart sometimes pounds so audibly that she dreads the places in the score where the orchestra plays pianissimo. Every night at home, after rehearsing for hours and hours, she plunges her feet, bruised and aching, into a bucket full of ice. She spends far too much of her pay on ice. Just the night before, she was woken out of a dead sleep by a pain in her left knee so intense that it kept her awake, worrying, is it over? Am I through? She is nearly used up now as a dancer, alone in the world, without a pension, without a husband. She could have had a husband if she hadn't continued with such naivete to believe that Paul Poiret would eventually marry her, that it was Jeannette and Jeannette alone he really loved. She finishes her hasty warm-up with a reverence, catching a last glimpse of herself in the mirror, realizing with horror that she forgot to put on her wreath of pink silk roses, pinning it as she scurries down the metal staircase, taking the last steps two at a time. She tries to seem invisible as she bolts past the regisseur, who is standing with his clipboard in the wings. He narrows his eyes at her and growls, 10 francs, Dupré. And her rent is due. The prelude is at the second to last bar. All the other dancers are poised and ready in the twilight on stage when Jeannette runs on, lowering herself down as noiselessly as possible among the other members of the corps and the demi-soloist, all of them reclining at Nijinsky's feet, with Anna Pavlova posed adoringly on one side of him and Tamara Karsavina on the other. Someone whispers something nasty sounding in Russian. Jeanette tries to slow her breathing in the 4 seconds left to her before the nocturne starts and the curtain rises.
The voice of Barbara Quick. May we end the program with a poem from your award-winning book so we can leave knowing the novelist and the poet.
Okay. Again, this is connected, called the poem my sister might have written here. So glad to see the moon again this morning above the mountain. She kept watch while I slept, rising full and butter yellow like a loving sister, a nightlight while I slept. I didn't fear the dark when she was there, in loco parentis, standing in for both our parents' love in different ways. My big sister lit the darkness in the room we shared, sang me endless Irish ballads till I fell asleep, transported by those stories from long ago. And then she left when I was 8 years old, left me in darkness on the mountain to find my way by starlight, barefoot on the heartless rocks, without a song or story, with no one there to watch me fall asleep and keep me safe.
The voice of Barbara Quick. This is the poet and the poem from the Library of Congress. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. Thank you, funders, the Sinipet Fund, Rivada Foundation, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.